a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 201. Oh my goodness. I'm back to the normal recording of my show, and I am in the 200s. Oh, absolutely shocks me. So I'm coming to you from Cincinnati, Ohio, still on vacation, working vacation, and checking out Cincinnati, Ohio as a possible site for a Calyx prototype, which I am super stoked on. I love Cincinnati. It's such a cool city. I'm really a giant fan. I have friends who live here, and it's just been blowing me away. Just what a cool city and the revitalization here that's happening. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit here in a second. But so if you missed it, episode 200 was a big two-hour special extravaganza. We had live callers from different places, different people in my life just randomly called in. It was so fun. People you've heard about on the show, some people you haven't heard about on the show. It was a good time. And I had Timothy Putnam from Outside the Walls and Leo Brown, the founder of Breadbox Media and host of the Leo Brown Almost Hour, sitting in. And we kind of did the morning show at night kind of a thing. It was fun. It was good. I'd never taken live calls before. I'd never really ran that kind of a show before. And I kind of dug it. I really want to get this thing kind of grown up and maybe start doing live shows once a week for a while or something. I've been wanting to wait for a while, but I really like the dynamic energy of the callers and not knowing what they're going to ask or say. And it was fun. It was really fun. I really enjoyed it. So if you haven't listened, I think only the first hour is up on the podcast right now. They're still editing the second half. That'll end up all up on there on the podcast, on Podbean, the Breadbox Media Podbean, and it'll go over onto the, iTunes when it's ready. But, excuse me. So, man, I'm tired. It's been a whirlwind of activity since, I got to Cincinnati, and not nearly enough good sleep. I'm sleeping on my buddy's couch while I'm in town, and I'm not exactly sleeping as much or as well as I need to be doing. So I'm going to need a vacation to get over my vacation, which is often the case for me. So anyway, some Cincinnati, Ohio, episode 201. I'm shocked as always that I've done 201 of anything, but here we are. I decided to let you guys have a rerun yesterday just because I just wasn't in a place that I could record well, and I'm having to find places to record while I'm out of town, and I apologize. The sound might be a little weird on this episode because I'm in my friend Tim's living room, and he has 13-foot ceilings, and it's all hard surfaces, and it's not like my normal studio or my normal office back in Denver. It's just a little live, a little hot. But so I tried to compensate as best I could, but it might get a little punchy at times. It's been a super good time. So last night, I want to talk a little bit about we went over and saw John Leindecker. Now John Leindecker, former Focus guy, graduate from Xavier University, studied philosophy. Or I guess he studied philosophy, Greek, and Latin in the program there. Just a really good dude. Just a really interesting guy that just deeply, deeply gets it. And he lives in the suburbs, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And we drove out there. One thing not a fan about with Cincinnati is there is a ton of construction going on. I'm used to that with Denver, Colorado, but there's just the traffic is just insane right now, especially when we waited too long and got stuck in rush hour trying to get out to Milford. Is that what it was? Outside of Cincinnati. It's a bedroom community of Cincinnati, but it was so beautiful. It's like, as a single Catholic guy, I had an experience last night that I always have when I hang out with a beautiful Catholic family. And now, hanging out with John himself, I'll talk about that a little bit. It was me and Tim went out and we hung out with John and his wife, and we spent a long time talking to John, and we talked about philosophy and theology and what's going on in the church, and, you know, big conversations. But it's interesting, every time I hang out with Catholic families, especially like my close friends that have these beautiful families, I come in and my initial reaction is, ah, see, this is what I need. I need a family. What am I doing? I'm single. This is just, I'm missing the best part of life. This is, I need to get a family. And then, you know, half an hour to an hour in, when you're having to kind of see them going, where's so-and-so? No, no, stop it. Tell him to get in here. You know, and it's like, you know, the father is constantly being interrupted by taking care of these kids, right? Then I start going, God, I get nothing done as it is. I would never get anything done. You know, and you start going, man, having a family is a lot of work. And then there's always some kind of moment. And last night it was, they got, everybody got their showers and baths and got ready for bed. And all their kids came down and they have an icon corner. And we sang, I guess it would be like a Byzantine compline. And all the kids are just singing, and then they go up, and we already had moments with the grace before the meal and stuff, but then they all sang Byzantine compline, the night prayer, and then each of the children went up, and their dad gave them a little blessing on the, and just like before they would go to bed, and it was just like, all right, this is what life is about right here. I am such a fan, man. This is what I just screwed up not having a family at this point. So I don't know. It's so funny. Just as a single guy, whenever you're hanging out with Catholic families, you're kind of going back and forth. You realize you go from idealization to overreaction to that idealization. And then to kind of what I think is a deep recognition of the end and what is the real point of family. And that happened when I was hanging out with John, with the Leyendeckers. So John and Lisa Leyendecker, just amazing people. They cooked us up a nice feast, smoked some sausages and stuff. It was so good. And we just did my favorite activity for the bulk of the night. Just me, Tim, John, drinking wine, talking philosophy and theology and telling stories and just having good conversation. And it was just absolutely spectacular. So that's kind of been one of the highlights of my trip to Cincinnati so far. So we did the live show. We hung out with the Leyendeckers. Other than that, me and Tim have basically talked philosophy and theology and went to different restaurants and coffee houses. That's pretty much all we've done. I think we're going to go see Captain Fantastic this afternoon. So Monday I will probably have a review of Captain Fantastic and some ideas about that, which is interesting because the guy's like homeschooling his kids with the great books out in the middle of nowhere. One of my friends posted the trailer online and said, hey, look, they made Thomas Aquinas College into a movie. It's like a great books out in the middle of nowhere. I'm like, well, there's a lot different in that his approach is different, but there's certainly some commonalities from what I could see in the trailer. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that Viggo Mortensen trying to turn his kids into philosopher kings out in the woods in Captain Fantastic. And I guess what we're going to be doing this afternoon or tonight when Tim gets back from his office, he had to go check the mail. So yeah, so I'm kind of on vacation and just checking out some stuff. So Cincinnati, man, is just, Kevin Clay and I came down here, I think it was like in the mid 90s, and we went over to a little coffee house on Main Street, and just, you know, I just scored a companion set to the great books, like the entire set, hardcover, perfect shape, for $10. I was blown away. Like, it was just cost nothing. It was a really great find in that little bookstore. And this city is just, but this city, it was kind of a run down at that point and over the Rhine. And then in, I guess it was 2000, 2001, somewhere in there, they had race riots, like full on riots in over the Rhine. And, it has just been, the city has just transformed. I thought Denver was exploding and every old building was being turned into something cool or something. I mean, Cincinnati, this part of Cincinnati we're in especially, makes Denver look like a stagnant suburb. I mean, this is just, the architecture alone here is just, so the area we're right outside of, and where the area we've been spending a lot of time, is called Over the Rhine. And over the, a lot of German immigrants got here in the Ohio River that look like the Rhine. And so they started building the kind of buildings that they built and setting up the city. And so the old part of Cincinnati down there, I mean, it's got the feel. I mean, it feels like you're in a European city, just the, all the architecture and all the churches. And there are places in this city where there's a church on every block. And I guess back in the day, these were churches for different ethnic groups with different languages. But it's a church on every block. It's just, I'm sitting in an apartment in a reconditioned old luxury hotel that's now apartments, and it's just so beautiful. It's just everything everywhere around you. You see this gorgeous old brick and stone architecture and this Italianate architecture with the curved windows and stuff, and it's just absolutely beautiful. Yeah. So if you haven't been to I would recommend Cincinnati. Just come check it out. And I have been blown away by the food, the food and the drinks and the spaces that they've created here. It's just such a cool city with so many great projects happening. I'm just a super fan. So, all right, when we get back, we're going to get a little more serious. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. See you on the other side.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See, only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. So it's interesting. You see, I was talking to my friend Tim, and just in Cincinnati, it seems like what they do instead of, they do this more like they do in Europe, instead of having just like a section of the city where all the Section 8 housing and the HUD and all the different, you know, all the public housing and all that, they don't just shove it all in one place. They kind of spread it out. And so there's parts of Cincinnati where you'll see public housing, and then a couple blocks away, there's just like straight up mansions. Like it doesn't seem like the really, really poor are super separated from everyone else here, the way it's laid out, which I think is good in the long run. You don't just create this ghetto off on the end of town where once you cross these tracks, the poor people live there. You know, it's just not just, and you just kind of herd them all into one place, and oh, and then we're just going to keep all these poor people over here. And it's really interesting because, you know, gentrification has been a big conversation in America, and I had experienced that kind of revitalization that some people would call gentrification, at least in St. Louis. But I mean, I saw there were neighborhoods that used to have abandoned buildings that whenever I was volunteering, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, volunteering for homeless winter patrol in St. Louis with New Life Ministries, we would be going into some of these abandoned buildings and finding people with needles hanging out of their arms and stuff, and just people completely destitute and on drugs and just like half frozen to death laying in these places. And those same abandoned buildings are all like restaurants and lofts and galleries and stuff now. There are places in St. Louis that I used to be scared to park my car, and now I can't afford to park my car. Can't afford to eat in any of those restaurants. Now, you could say, well, yeah, and they came in, they drove everybody out. But, I mean, it was all abandoned warehouses. It wasn't like there was a thriving middle class or even a thriving lower class. There were abandoned buildings, right? And then again, in like Denver right now, you know, there's a real serious revitalization happening, say, like in like the Rhino District in River North. But it's an industrial district. It was in some ways kind of an abandoned in places and kind of like run down industrial area. And now it's being turned into businesses and bars and cafes and print shops and all kinds of different businesses. And they're kind of revitalizing this warehouse district. But it wasn't really a residential district. And it's interesting, you see, but in Cincinnati, you see, over the Rhine Tim was just showing me one building after another they're putting in such and such here, and they brought in this architect, and they're going to do this thing, this new theater here with the, you know, whatever. And it's, yeah, this wasn't a completely abandoned building. There was just like, it was all boarded up, and it's like, you know, there was just like, you could drive down the street and there'd be like maybe one building in this block had anything in it, you know? And so I look at that and I go, wow, this is, you know, revitalization. This is like people are coming in and there's literally these really like a well over 100-year-old buildings that are just gorgeous old brick Italianate buildings that were just abandoned. And now they're becoming beautiful spaces with beautiful businesses and people creating delicious or interesting things and selling them to people, and people are making money and spending money. But there's a side of that where it's like, okay, now the rents are going up and there is residential, and it pushes people out. And I guess there was a real push before that against this gentrification. And so then there's a question. It's like, how do you do that? Are the options to just leave a neighborhood alone and not allow anyone to come in and do anything because it might raise the rents or it might make, you know? But it's like, wait, so I want to come into this place, make it safer, make something beautiful, bring some people down here to spend some money. But the thing that I'm doing wrong is making the place more attractive, and the market is going to respond, and it's going to be, people are going to want to live here. And so people who can only afford something really cheap won't be able to live here anymore, because you can only afford to live like in a demilitarized zone. So if we kind of get the demilitarization, kind of like we clean the place up and make it less violent or whatever, then they can't afford to. So what do you do? It's like, do you just like rely on the government? I mean, I think there has to be a conversation on I brought all this up to say that I think that this is a very good example of where subsidiarity needs to play in. Now, subsidiarity is a concept in Catholic social doctrine where it says that basically whatever laws and rules that need to affect men's lives, that those rules and laws and interventions should take place on the lowest level, the most local level, nearest that person that's affected by them, as can be done well, right? And so I think that cities are a good example, or neighborhoods are a good example, where you get together and you say, okay, we obviously have a problem here, but we don't want to create a completely non-diverse neighborhood. We don't want to just save all these buildings and run everyone out and no one can afford to live here. So we're going to, but we know our culture, we know who's here, we know what cultures are struggling and what are not struggling, and we know, and it's like you can come up with a solution on a very local level that might not work someplace else just because of the way that the neighborhood's laid out, the type of architecture that's there, the type of cultures that are there, the type of industry that could respond and come to the place and all that, you know. And it seems to me from, and maybe I'm just seeing this with the eyes of someone who loves to see old buildings turned into cool cocktail bars and coffee houses, but it seems like they've really done a good job with revitalizing Cincinnati, but not making it like this cookie cutter, completely just plain vanilla boring place with all one kind of people. I saw a very diverse set of people as we were walking around over the Rhine going to cafes and stuff. And so I think that it seems to me that, I don't know, I just, if anybody's interested in this kind of thing, I think that Cincinnati might be a good model to look at, because again, I guess industry put a lot of money in there. Some of the local industries put a lot of money into the revitalization efforts in this old town, and they've just really changed things. They've really turned things around. So I think Cincinnati's a good model to look at. And so it's the first time I've gotten to be kind of on the ground, walking around with someone who kind of knows the history of everything and who's really mindful. My friend Tim is just brilliant and very mindful about these things, and I could throw questions at him and ask him things, and I just feel like I got a taste of a very particular, very local solution to the gentrification issue. And I don't know, it's just a conversation, because I help design coffee houses and launch them for people. I often am involved in projects where we're taking an old building in an up and coming neighborhood and turning it into something. And the hope is that being in that block will create a synergy with the other couple things in that block, and it'll be an attractive place to come. And then the other buildings that are kind of empty on that block, maybe they'll see that synergy. They'll be able to find a niche within the people that we're drawing, and then come in. And so, I mean, I kind of take part in the projects that could be called gentrification. But at the same time, I mean, I think I try to be mindful from kind of a Catholic social doctrine perspective about, you know, are we just going in and buying up this building and putting a restaurant or a cafe in it that is completely contrary to everything about the neighborhood, and, you know, selling a product that the current residents of this neighborhood could never afford to come get, and then basically just like taking advantage of cheap rents and cheap buildings and then pushing everyone out of that so that we can now have our fun in your old place. You know, I don't know. It's fraught with lots and lots of, it's fraught with lots of problems, but if you just walking, and I've kind of been thinking about that here lately, and then I came to Cincinnati and I started walking around over the Rhine and just seeing just how positive everything is there, and just how different it is, and how a city can come from, you know, kind of a really being really run down in the 60s through the 90s, and then race riots in the early 2000s, and then now just this beautifully diverse, kind of interesting, super positive, kind of cool thing that's happening in over the Rhine in this neighborhood in Cincinnati. It just made me feel like, okay, look, there's models of how this is being done out there, and this seems like a decent one. So that was one thing I had on my mind, was this whole process of gentrification. And I was really blown away by what Cincinnati's done. It's just exploding with revitalization right now. This every abandoned building seems like it's being bought up and turned into something really cool. And so if you're living in a city where you'd like to figure out how to do that, I think a trip to Cincinnati and just walking around over the Rhine would be a good step in that direction to figure out what it would look like if you did it right. So, all right, so let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then how we crave a hanging in its dark.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. I was talking about how we've seen so many beautiful businesses and cafes and stuff. And so we went to a cocktail bar that is an old pharmacy. I think it's Sundry and Vine. Is that what it's called? It was, they'd remodeled this old building. It was just absolutely beautiful. They had a really, really great cocktail menu. Kind of reminded me of Williams and Graham in the Highlands in Denver. But one thing that they had, so there's a couple things I want to talk about, because I've seen some cool stuff since I've been in Cincinnati. This is kind of my catch up on all the stuff I've seen in Cincinnati episode. So they had batch cocktails, which is something that I've batch draft cocktails, which is something I've never seen before. And so what they do is they had a Vieux-Carré before, which is kind of my favorite cocktail right now, but they had a Negroni, and they had a Manhattan, or maybe it was an old fashioned. I think it was a Manhattan. And they basically pick these drinks where pretty much all of the ingredients have alcohol in them, so they're not going to get old. And they make a giant batch, and they kind of get better as they sit and kind of interpenetrate the different and become kind of one thing. And they put them in these little 5-gallon kegs, and then they hook them up to a draft system like you would, and have them on tap like you would a beer. And so you order a Manhattan, and they rinse out your glass, put some big, thick 2-inch ice cubes in it, and then pull this little tap and fill it up with X amount of Manhattan and hand it to you. And I thought that was cool. You know, I remember the first time I saw wine on tap, which now has just become very, very common, having your house wines on tap. But I remember the father's office down in Santa Monica, I think when he built his new restaurant over in Culver City, it was the first time I'd seen wine on tap before. And I just thought that was just crazy. And so now, you know, we see coffee on tap, you see cold brew on tap, nitro coffee on tap, these different types of things going on tap, kombucha on tap. I know that out in California, I went to G&B in the Grand Central Market, and they had a cold brew white tea with Citra hops that had been carbonated and put on a draft system. And that was a stunning drink. So when we designed Shrine Coffee up in Santa Cruz, the project I'm working on with Ann Breiling, go to shrinecoffee.com and give some money to Shrine Coffee so that we can get that beautiful shop done. We put in a tap system over by the windows, by the outdoor patio, and so that we could do cold brew, nitro coffee, a kombucha tap, and then have an experimental tap for things like cold brew teas infused and elixirs and whatever, you know. Probably get us some probably get a Tractor Soda machine in there too for my friend Justin Schneer's new company, Tractor Soda, which is amazing. I'm kind of interested in what you can do with you know, because the tap thing is kind of the same thing that's happening with the return of batch brew in the coffee houses and the backlash against the fetishization of manual brewing and pour overs and all that. There's kind of a new egalitarianism and kind of just a very practical kind of a love of being able to let a machine do what a machine does best so that you can focus on a customer. You know, and so I've seen that applied in wine. I've seen it applied in coffee in different ways, but never seen it with cocktails. And I thought that was really interesting. So if you're a cocktail type or a kind of person that owns a hospitality business or something along those way, I would suggest maybe thinking about draft cocktails, putting cocktails on tap. I'm definitely going to show, I'm going to tell L. Taylor at Amethyst Coffee about this when I get back and see if she's interested in playing with something like this. Pretty cool stuff. So that was fun. The draft cocktail thing was pretty interesting. And really beautiful space, an old apothecary or like an old, I think it was an old drugstore, that they just they used enough of the old stuff that was still there and kind of, you know, in kind of that cool modern kind of like revitalization, using what was there before and working that into the brand and all that. Just a cool space and just very nice people. Our server was, our bartender just did such a great job, and she was so forthcoming with information and so good with hospitality. And that's another thing that makes these small businesses just so beautiful. They're so personal. They're so carefully made, and so in the hospitality so good. Now, a couple of fails I've had though. I went to a really beautiful, very sleek, very third wave coffee bar in downtown Cincinnati as part of a hotel and gallery. And we were just walking by and I saw Mod Bar. So Mod Bar is a brand and a style of equipment where you put all of the inner workings of the machinery of the espresso machine and under the counter, and it's just these little chrome taps coming out of the counter. I've designed two kind of pods with Mod Bar in it as the service areas and the production areas at Shrine Coffee in Santa Cruz. And I love Mod Bar. I'm going to probably put it in almost every one of the Calyx shops because it takes all the barriers between you and the customer out, and they can see what you're doing and you can see them, and it's more personal. So I was excited and I walked in and I saw bags of coffee that I recognized from good roasters, and it's a beautiful space and all the right, you know, little vessels and stuff. And the guys behind the counter, you know, looked like they were, you know, the type of people that, you know, need to be working in a shop like that. And I'm like, nice. And so I went up and ordered an espresso, and they were just like talking about us as if we weren't there. Oh, do you want to make his espresso? No, you can make it. You want me to make it? Yeah, you make it. And it took forever for them to get my coffee. I'm sitting there talking to my friend Tim about in detail about the type of equipment they have and this grinder they had, a white EK43. And I'm like, here's why people get these EK43s. And the new Melconic Peak has a similar burr set in it because it makes its particle size. It's really fine. And so they're overhearing this guy talk to his friend and explain every drop of their equipment. And obviously, I know a lot about the whole coffee thing. Nothing. Normally in any coffee house I've ever been in that's worth its salt, they'd be like, oh, hey, so you have a shop somewhere? Yeah, cool. Right on. Whose coffee do you, you would have like, they would have dove in. Nothing. The guy behind the counter had some cool tattoos, had an anatomical heart stuff, had a Cairo, like an ancient symbol for Jesus tattooed. So like has like some Christian, really cool kind of Christian hipster tattoos. I'm like, we mentioned it. Oh, it's a Kiro. Oh, cool. Yeah, we're nothing. It's like zero interaction with this whatsoever. I'm just like, what in the world? And now then this morning, I went to this little, so here's a Cincinnati story. I went to this little breakfast place right by my friend Tim's apartment called Proud Rooster, I think it is. It's evidently a Cincinnati institution. And I got your basic like little breakfast combo, right? They had an option of something called Geta. Now, I had no idea what it was. So I'm like, I have to ask, what's Geta? And she's like, oh, you're not from here. I'm like, yeah. So it's a kind of like scrapple. It's pinpoint oats with pork and spices and stuff. It's kind of a finely ground hash meets the innards from sausage, kind of fried. It's a very German thing. A lot of German stuff going on here. The Germans were the people who founded a lot of the stuff around Cincinnati. And so it's a very German thing. I looked it up and I'm like, yeah, give me that for my meat, you know? So, and I got it. And I have to say, I am a giant fan of Geta. It was delicious. It was spectacular. Like, they sell it in the grocery store here I'm going to buy some before I go home and cook it when I get back to Denver, or like learn how to make it or try to find a source for it. It's delicious. It's just a spiced ground oat and pork thing that's like, evidently they have festivals here for the stuff. And so the lady, this is a real, you know, kind of your, a very working class blue collar diner of an institution. But they had something interesting that was culinarily interesting. They responded to my asking about it and just gave me great service and great information and just perfect service and hospitality in this diner. Right. So you can, so I guess the moral of the story of that second half of this segment is you can have all the right equipment, a beautifully, perfectly designed, super gorgeous, sleek space in a perfect location, and just not get it and not have the common sense of how to wait on people and how to take care of them and how to make them feel welcome. And you can have like an old school diner with bad coffee, which wasn't too bad, but it was like, you know, just like your typical kind of diner, nothing highbrow whatsoever, and knock it out of the park when it comes to hospitality and making someone feel at home. I had both of those. I had all three of those experiences today, and so that just got me thinking about the people think when I talk about hospitality, people always think I'm talking about something highbrow. I'm not talking about something highbrow. So anyway, let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so today we are doing the Cincinnati Potpourri episode, where I just kind of give you the... I'm catching up on all the insights and things I've seen since I've been in Cincinnati, just kind of a travel edition, and thoughts on hospitality and revitalization, because that's kind of what I do in this world because of my project Calyx. And so you know what, speaking of Calyx, so as I said before, I went out to John and Lisa Leindecker's house with my friend Tim and got them introduced, and it was great because I didn't realize that John had gone to studied philosophy at Xavier, and so they knew a ton of the same people. Right, my friend Tim and him know all the same people and had a bunch of close friends, mutual, and so I really feel like I introduced two people that will hang out a lot after I'm gone now, and they will be friends, and I've created community, you know. And it's kind of like I'm Andrew, right? So kind of like St. Andrew, I am my namesake, where St. Andrew's two great claims to fame, well, short of maybe what he did after Christ died and rose, but you know, with his missionary journeys, but during the life of Christ, his two famous moments are his two claims to fame are basically going, Peter, meet Jesus, Jesus, Peter, I'll let you guys talk. And then later on, he's like, Jesus, these are Greeks here, talk to Jesus. And then that's it. That's what Andrew did. He's the networker. He's the guy that says, I got a guy you should know. And so I love when I can introduce two people that I think are going to hit it off and mean something to each other in this world, and then sit back and watch the sparks fly and watch it happen, you know? And I got a chance to do that last night with my friend Tim and my friend John. So that was a blast. That was a good time. But then, so we finally settled down into the living room, and the kids were all off to bed, and it was just us guys, and we were talking, and I started talking about Calyx and started asking them questions. And because John used to work at Focus, and I knew that he had a lot of insights, and he works for an apostolate now, and I knew he had a lot of insights about how to reach people and how to develop people that are doing evangelization and whatever. And I started telling him about Calyx and about these places we want to build. And it was just great. We had a really great conversation, and I kind of felt like I was pitching in a sense, that like trying to talk him into thinking this is a good idea or doable or whatever. And then then he kind of started talking and was just going, no, there's no reason you can't do this. And all the things that I was throwing out there is kind of caveats. Like, look, I don't know. I don't know if donors are going to understand this and this, and it's going to be kind of hard here, and this is going to be difficult. And he was like, no, I don't think that'll be hard at all. Here's what you do. And just, so it was so great to basically come someplace, see someone that you know has a long history as an apostle, someone who's really been in the trenches doing a lot of work with a lot of different types of people over the years, and kind of lay your vision before them. And the same thing kind of happened with my friend Tim, kind of on the intellectual side and kind of the way things, because he teaches and he talks, you know, he does it with kids and in teaching them and getting them to have some wonder and to open themselves up to reality. And both in different ways, both of them have, you know, heard what I had to say and said, no, I think what you're doing is really important. And John saying, no, I think what you're doing is important. It's very doable. I think here's what you do and here's what you don't do and here's what you focus on. And I don't think there's any reason you can't make this happen, you know? And it was good because I get these plans in my head and I tend to think that these are just kind of like pipe dreams or something. And then I'm kind of starting to really pull the trigger on some stuff that I've just been whiteboarding to death for a long time. And to have people who know this stuff better than me say, no, I think that's really important and I think you can do that. I was like, okay, so I'm not crazy. No, I don't think you're crazy. I think it's a good insight. I think that's powerful and I think it's going to happen. Oh, thanks. Praise God. I mean, this is really personally very meaningful. And I guess I'll revisit just the time you spend just after eating a good meal, drinking some wine, and just having free, wonder-driven conversation and hammering out ideas and talking about things and, you know, just especially around the realm of philosophy and theology but even talking about travel and stuff like that, it's just, oh goodness. It just makes me so happy. That's what I want to do with my life. I'm never happier than when I am just sitting with 2 to 4 people with a glass of wine in my hand, just talking and just chatting. And but very high end chat, talking just wonder driven, just speculation and insights. And, you know, hey, have you read such and such? You know how he says X, Y, and Z? Isn't it kind of like that? Except, yeah, I think that's right. And it's like, you know, you're just talking about, you're with people who are mindful, good, interesting, thoughtful, educated human beings that still have some wonder left in them. And you just have these beautiful conversations. It's just, that's literally what I, at a few shows ago when we were talking about what do you want to do when you're martyred. I mean, I think that's where I'd want to go. maybe just like, you know, if I was really actually going to be martyred, I'd probably want to be like an adoration or something. But I don't know. It's a good way to go. I mean, I'd like to go out doing what I do, doing what I'm built to do. And I think that that's a good chunk of what I'm built to do in this world. So that was good. And I think that seeing a place like Cincinnati and over the Rhine and what they're doing is I saw a lot of people, you know, when I was in Austria a couple years ago, Austria is a city where people entertain in public. So you go out and there's a lot of people just dwelling in public. They're dwelling in cafes and in bars and they're sitting outside and, you know, this part of Cincinnati here and in the scene around here, where all this revitalization is taking place, just really feels like that. It feels like a place where, you've created a neighborhood. Like, we went to this place where there's a bunch of people doing yoga in the park, and next to where everybody was doing yoga, there was a place where, you know, the water and the lights shoot at you. There's light and water shooting out of the sidewalk and the concrete, and little kids in swimsuits were out there running back and forth in the water. And, you know, there was a little gazebo with a little pop-up bar attached to it with some cool cocktails and some wine and a bunch of outdoor furniture that was real ergonomic and comfortable. And all these people were just kind of sitting outside in the shade and having a drink and watching the kids play and stuff. And just, and then you go down the street and there's just like cafe after cafe. It's just full of people sitting and talking, and people sitting on outdoor furniture outside these places and talking. And they're just, you get the feel like, oh, there's people living, and they're living in public. They're living together. They're dwelling there. You can see who's there. You can get a feel, and people are approachable, and people are, I didn't get a feel like, there's some places that you go and you walk past the place and you go, oh, that's for that type of people. I'm not welcome. I wouldn't really be welcome there. Or here's a table full of people, and even if we were just kind of standing there waiting for a table or something, we wouldn't strike up a conversation with those people, because you just get the vibe that you wouldn't be welcomed into the conversation. I don't know how to describe it. Just in Cincinnati, and I see this in Denver a lot too, but not to the extent that I see it in over the Rhine here in Cincinnati. You get a feeling that each of these little pods of people, each of these little sub-contexts, be it a business, be it an outdoor community kind of space, be it just some public furniture, public art that people are gathered around, you kind of get the feeling that an environment has been created where you're welcome. You could insert yourself and people would let you insert yourself. That, I think that's why my experience at that fancy espresso bar today, where we just weren't really welcomed and we weren't brought in, we weren't engaged, we weren't, you know, and I tried. I and you know me, I can talk, if you've listened to the show at all, and if you're one of my friends who listens, you know me, I can talk to anybody about anything. But my goodness, me talking to people that are working in a high-end, beautiful, cutting-edge coffee bar, and the guy's got like ink that shows that he's got, you know, he's some kind of a Christian with kind of an interest in things kind of historical on his arm. I mean, that's just a slow pitch right down the middle for me. Nothing. I mean, I was just, that's why it's that, it's not like that doesn't happen, but it happening in Cincinnati was just kind of a strange thing, because I guess as I reflected on that experience, I realized that it seemed so out of place. Because, I mean, we had lunch in a nice French bistro today that was a pretty fancy restaurant. It was really affordable, like surprisingly affordable, but it's pretty nice, pretty fancy place. And I was really made to feel at home. I felt very at home and very comfortable in this space. So even in the nicer places we've been very, very welcomed. And so I don't know, I guess they're just kind of building something like that here. And it's got me thinking about bigger than just a shop. It's got me thinking about, what do you do when you do this to a neighborhood? Maybe if you're not thinking about one space, but you're thinking about like a piazza, or you're thinking about a neighborhood, you're thinking about a group of spaces and a group of contexts making up a larger context. Anyway, this is the crazy stuff that goes through my head whenever I'm walking around a new city like Cincinnati, seeing a bunch of old Italianate buildings that have been turned into hipster cocktail bars. So, all right, well, there you go. You get the Cincinnati decompress all my ideas episode here. So thanks for coming out. I appreciate it. And we'll see you next time. Let's pull the plug and pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.